so I can read it without my glasses. Okay, I think we're going to start now. I want to welcome you to Congregation Beth HaMidrash and to Midrashet Yom Rishon, which we're hosting for this week, and we're very appreciative of that. And our guest speaker today is Dr. Michelle Levine. She's a tenured associate professor of Bible in the Jewish Studies Department at the Stern College for Women at Yeshiva University. Dr. Levine received her MS from Bernard Revel Graduate School at YU and her PhD in Medieval Biblical Exegesis from New York University. She also went to study at Mechala in Israel. She has been teaching courses in Tanakh and Parshanut on the advanced level at Stern College for over a decade. She has published numerous articles and delivered papers at academic conferences on medieval biblical commentaries, particularly on Ramban's commentary on Chumash. Most recently, she published her book, Nachmanides on Genesis, The Art of Biblical Portraiture, with Brown University Press, and that's based on her doctoral dissertation. She lectures extensively at various shuls and Jewish organizations and teaches two classes in Queens. If you know anybody in Queens who would like to go to a really good class, they should get in touch with her and find out where they are. I heard her last March at the Yom Iyun at YU, which is also an excellent program that happens once a year, and so I'm really looking forward to today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. This past Shabbat, we stood on Har HaMoriah together with Avraham Avinu. We witnessed in source number one, Vayishlach Avraham et yado vayikach et hamachelet lishchot et bino, that he's about to slaughter his very beloved son Yitzchak. At the last minute, the Malach calls out to him and stops him. Al tishlach yaducha el anav. Ve'atas lo me'umad. Don't do anything. Because now I know, ki yireh Elokim ata, that you are one who fears Hashem. Says the Midrash in source number two, pay attention how I organize the booklet. The right-hand column are the psukim, which we are going to discuss. The left-hand column are the related commentaries aligned with the psukim. The Midrash, the Yalkut Shimoni, in source number two says, when Yitzchak came down the mountain, Avraham had just succeeded in passing the greatest challenge and trial of his life. He was full of triumph. And yet, when Yitzchak comes back to his mother, there is tragedy. Yitzchak says, Ima, nitalani abba ve'aleni harim v'orideni gva'ot ve'aleni lo rosh harichal du'banam izbeach. Abba took me up the mountain and he almost sacrificed me. He took the knife and he was about to slaughter me. And where I underlined, Ilulei shamalo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, al tishlach yadecha ha'na'ar, kvar hayiti shachut, if the malach had not stopped Abba, I would have been slaughtered. Amra lo, she said to her son, Vai lecha barada lufta, my poor son, Ilulei damar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, al tishlach yadecha ha'ita shachut, you would have almost been killed if Avraham had not been stopped at the last moment. Lo ispika lomar davar ad sheyatzea nishmata. The shock was too great for Sara Imenu to bear, and she passed away with this unbelievable, overwhelming news. And therefore, when we read in source number 5 in Pasuk Bet Batamat Sarah, we read at the end of the pasuk, "Vayavo Avraham lispod leSarah velivkota." And the midrash in source number 2 asks, "Where was he coming from?" Mehechan ba. And the midrash answers, "Mehar Hamoriah ba." He was coming back from Har Hamoriah. And Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, in a work that we will quote towards the end of the shir, which has a number of collated essays called Min HaSe'ara, the Rav says, can you imagine the tragedy after the triumph and the trial? The tragedy that Abraham is coming back, realizing that he has been accepted as the intimate chosen one of Hashem, and he can't wait to tell the news. And in the end, he has to come back to cry over his dear wife and to mourn for her. The Rav says we need to pay attention that there are two acts of tragedy, of expression of tragedy here. There's the crying and the mourning. On the one hand, he is crying for his beloved wife. This is a personal outcry of a woman who stood by his side through thick and thin. They were a power couple, a tag team. They worked together. And perhaps this is why we read in source number 5 in Pasuk Aleph of Perek Chav Gimel the details of the event of her death. First we learn about her life. Vayu chaye sara mea shana ve'srim shana ve'sheva shanim shnei chaye sara, rather redundant. She lived 127 years. And then again it recaps. These were the years of the life of Sarah. Why? Ask the Mefarshim. Most of the time, we don't learn about the deaths of our imahot. We don't know when Rivka died, only through allusion. We never hear any mention about Leah's death. And while we know about Rachel's death, because unfortunately she died in childbirth, we don't know how long she lived. We don't even know exactly how old Yitzchak was at the Akedah. We have to do a little math. But here we are told very clearly, these are Shnei Chayei Sarah, the years of her life. On the one hand, the Rashbam in source number 6 tells us, because her death is going to be quite momentous, monumental. Because as he says in source number 6, where I underline, Utzrach laskir mitata, bishvil kinyan hame'ara, peresh matai meta lachal tishim shororat horata. The acquisition of Me'arat HaMachpelah, which will be the main focus of our shir today, is predicated on the fact that it was precipitated by the momentous event of her death. But yet Rashi says, in source number 7, quoting the Midrash, we learn a lot more about the description of the years of her life. She was at the age of 100, like 20 for sin, never meriting any kind of... What happened? Oh, never... can you hear me without it? Would you prefer without it? Okay. Never meriting... I told them I project. Never meriting any punishment. When she was 20, she was as beautiful as when she was 7 years old. And the Maharal, who wrote a perush on Rashi, Sefer Gur Aryeh, asks the question, since when especially do we praise a matriarch or any woman for her beauty, her physical beauty? Don't we read in Eshet Chayil, Sheker Achein, Vehevel Hayofi? So the Maharal in source number 7 says, Sarai tashlema bechol elu bet chalakim. Lo haya bachisaron. That means in her guf and her nefesh. Im shleimut haguf v'im shleimut hanefesh hayta shleima. Her internal beauty was reflected in her external beauty. In totality, her soul, her body reflected complete righteousness. This is the woman over whom Avraham is crying. He lost his beloved wife, his Ezer Kenegdo, his partner in life. But there is more to it. And that's why the Rav emphasizes it's not just the crying, but there's the mourning, lispod. Because As we noted, in relationship to the event of her death, which the Midrash says was caused by the trial of the Akedah, Avraham begins to realize what has really taken place here. As we read in source number 3, we know that Sarah, as a devoted woman, went out of her homeland together with Avram, Lech Lecha. She went on a journey to the unknown, El Haaretz Asher Al-Eka, to a place where Hashem had promised, Ve'escha L'goy Gadola, make you into a great nation. Ve'agadla Shmecha, I will make your name great. Later on, Hashem had promised to these very children, Eretz Megurecha, Kol Eretz Kenan, La'achuzat Olam, in source number 4, a land which will be his eternal stronghold and possession. At the event of the Akedah, Avraham almost lost promise number 1, children. This was such a shocking experience that it took Sarah's life away. But Avraham is now also shaken by what has happened to him in Har HaMoriah, because Sarah understood that without children, the entire legacy, the entire mission for which she had lived and which she had worked, was almost for naught. In the blink of an eye, almost everything was lost. We know in source number 9, Sarah, according to the Midrash, whose name was also Yiska, is because she was Socha Beruach HaKodesh. She was a prophetess in her own right. And very importantly, she was known as Yiska, tells us the Maharal, the Gur Aryeh, before she married Avraham. The Midrash is even intimating that she found Hashem on her own and became a Nevi'ah before she even married Avraham. They were truly a power couple. Source 11, we learn Avraham megayer et ha'anashim, v'Sarah megayeret et ha'nashim. Avraham converts the men, she converts the women. Avram understood she had worked so hard to create a legacy for her husband and her divine, in this divine mission. And he saw how it was almost lost. So Avraham says to himself, Hashem gave me back my child to take down from the mountain. To be able to have this child, and now in the next perek, he's going to look for a wife so that the legacy can be carried on. He therefore realizes he cannot sit still about the second promise, the promise of land. It was not merely enough for him any longer to have walked through the land. Remember, Hashem had commanded him, walk in all directions throughout the land. This was just a symbolic walking, to acquire the land in escrow for his children, for when eventually they will later on conquer the land. No, Avraham wants an actual conquest, an acquisition, a possession of the land of Canaan during his lifetime. And he sees the great opportunity for this when Sarah dies, and now he can purchase land for her burial site. In this way, he will be able to perpetuate her memory as a matriarch and all that she strove for, to truly make the land of Canaan the Achuzat Olam, which he was promised. Therefore, we read in source number 12, Pasuk Gimel and Perek Chav Gimel, Vayakom Avraham me'al penei metol, says the Rav. Avraham is crying over his wife. He's mourning over his matriarch. But he pulls himself up, he gets up, and he does what he has to do. And he approaches B'nai Chet with a proposal. Ger v'toshav, in the middle of source 12. Ger v'toshav anochi imachem.
תנו לי אחוזת קבר עמכם ואקברה מתי מלפני.
Abraham identifies his legal status in the land. He wants to purchase the land, kedin v'kedat, so that in the future there will be no contest regarding his legal right to this land. A contractual, legal series of negotiations are about to ensue. Give and take. What does Abraham say? Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. I am a ger, a stranger. I was not born in Canaan. I am not a native resident of the land. Vitoshav, but now I am a resident of the land. Now, it's very interesting, however, when you look through some English translations of this phrase, ger vitoshav, that one always must keep in mind that translation is always a form of commentary, a form of parshanut. So there are some modern English translations that render the phrase ger v'toshav as I am a resident alien, or I am a foreign settler. One of the underlying innuendos of that particular rendition sounds like, well, I may be living here, but I'm still really a foreigner. So therefore, I'm seeking out from you, Hittites, your good graces. I'm asking for a concession from you because I really don't have the legal right to ask this of you, as I am not an official citizen of the land nor a native of the land. Ramban, however, in source number 13, reads the tone of this entire initial statement completely differently. He says, "Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, haya haminhag liot lahem batei kvarot ish levet avotav. V'sedek kvura echad yikavru bo kol hagerim." Normally, everyone had their own ancestral burial site. And then there was one common burial area for all of the foreigners. Abraham says, where I underlined, Ani ger me'eretz acheret. It's true, I am a stranger from another land. V'lo inchalti me'avotai beit ha'kvarot ba'aretz hazot. I do not have, therefore, an ancestral burial possession. Vihine ata, but now ani toshav imachem. I am a resident among you. Chafatzti lashevet ba'aretz hazot. I want to live in this land. Lachen tnu kever li le'achuzat olam. Therefore, give me a burial site as an eternal possession, holding ke'echad mikem. Like one of you. Listen to the difference. Says Ramban, I may have been a ger, but now, quoting Abraham, I am a resident among you. I am a full legal citizen with full status. I am a toshav, and therefore I want to be imachem. I want to be like one of you. I want to live among you. Therefore, I want an achuzat kever, a full possession, acquisition of land to belong to me for all generations for burying the dead. So let's see what the Hittites have to say about this. Source number 14. Counter negotiations. Vayanu b'nei chet ed Avraham lemor lo. Shema'enu. Oh, listen to us, Avraham. Adoni. My master? That's very interesting. Avraham didn't call them masters, where one would have thought that would be appropriate if he is beseeching them or at least requesting something from them. But they call him Adoni, my master. And epithets as Nechama Leibowitz and others emphasize are very pointed.
and very focused on eliciting the point of view of the biblical personalities at certain junctures within a narrative. Because the question we need to ask is, did they call him this appellation merely out of polite respect, a formal way of address? If so, like I said, he should have called them my masters. But then they complicate things because they call him Nisi Elohim or Elohim, Ata Bitochenu. Why give Avraham this unusual honorific epithet, a prince of God? Let's first see what they say. B'mivchar kvarenu kvor et metecha. Ish mimenu et kivro lo yichlem mimecha mikvor metecha. You are a prince of God among us. In the choicest of our graves, bury your dead. No one from among us will prevent you from burying your dead. Well, Avraham should have gone home. Thank you very much. You gave me everything I want. You let me bury my dead. The story's over. Why isn't Avraham satisfied? Because the Hittites are talking in what one scholar calls the art of double talk. They say, you can bury your dead. Of course, we would never stop you from burying your dead. That's immoral. But where do they want him to bury his dead? B'mivchar kvarenu, among our graves. Pick any existing grave you want. You don't want to use the common grave for foreigners. Well, we can understand that. So pick any one of our ancestral burial plots and bury your dead there. None of us will prevent you from burying your dead. Do you hear the double negatives? Double negatives don't always necessarily mean a positive. We're not giving you really what you want. They're conceding on the one hand, but denying on the other. And if Avraham is not shrewd, and he doesn't listen to the innuendo of what they are offering, he'll just take the deal and walk away. They don't want him to have an achuzat olam, a possession for himself. They want him merely to bury his dead in an existing burial plot, and the fact that he buries his dead there will post facto mean the burial site belongs to him, but the land itself does not belong to him. Why do they call him a Nasi Elohim? Well, Ibn Ezra in source 15 tells us it's an honorific title because he's a Navi. Ralbag in source 16 tells us he's a reputable individual in the eyes of Hashem. Notice these two commentators are understanding this title in a religious sense, that he is a religious leader. Well, that makes sense. We know at the beginning of Parashat Lech Lecha that he builds altars, Vayikra B'Shem Hashem, and Ramban says that he calls out to all the passers-by. Ramban basically maintains that Avraham is very good at Kiruv. Excellent. He's a very religious man. Quite reputable in that sense. And yet Ramban in source 17 says differently. If you look for the moment at the end of the third line, Aval ata melech, himlichacha ha'elokim aleinu v'anachnu v'admatenu avadim lecha. Very, very stark language here. You are a prince of God, says Ramban, and he's quite unique among the commentators in this analysis. You are literally a king among us. We and our land are your servants. How could Avraham be a king among them? And yet Ramban, interestingly, is understanding prince, not in a religious sense, but in a political sense. Perhaps Ramban is thinking, why would the Hittites at this juncture invoke religiosity? We're dealing with legal contractual negotiations for the acquisition of land. This is politics. So therefore, the Hittites say, politically, Avraham, you have a lot of clout over us. Of course, this is very different from various scholars who understand that Avraham is approaching them as an obeisant foreigner who feels vulnerable, seeking concessions and good graces. They say to him, why did you call yourself a ger v'toshav? Call yourself who you really are in our eyes. You are a prince, our master, Adoni, with political implications. Somehow, Avraham carried himself by walking through the land, having a tent with open doors, in a way that evoked an impression of royalty. What are the sources for Ramban's analysis? Difficult to discern. However, it is very interesting that in source 19, which parallels the first quotation in Bereshit Yudalit in source 18, the Midrash tells us that when Avraham entered on the political scene as a warrior, in chapter 14, when he fought the war between the four kings and the five kings in order to rescue Lot, the text reads in source 18 that the king of Sodom came out to greet him in an area called Emek Shaveh Hu Emek HaMelech. Sensitive always to redundancies and reiterations, Midrash says in source 19 that what they do is they flattened an area down, hishvu, an area they cut down trees, they made a podium, and they put him on top, they raised him up, so to speak, on a pedestal, and he became melech. They said, you are our king. And amazingly, this Midrash, which is commenting on chapter 14, quotes us from this Hittite declaration in chapter 23. Amru lo, where I underlined, melech at aleinu, nasi at aleinu, Elohim at aleinu. Notice they're understanding Elohim in this context as a ruler. Of course, in this particular Midrash, Avraham really doesn't want to be a ruler because he says, God is the only true ruler. I don't want you to mistake me for another god with a little g, chas v'shalom. But you can certainly see how this Midrashic source might have influenced Ramban in understanding. We have to think carefully. The Avot were not private figures who kept to themselves. They were very public, out there individuals in Eretz Kanaan. So much so that the Ramban teaches us in source number 20, that when Hashem had promised in Bereshit Yud Gimel, I left out the quote of the Pasuk by accident. Let me quote it for you. Kum hitalech ba'aretz le'orka ule'rochba, ki lecha etenena ule'zaracha acharecha. Walk throughout the land because to you I will give the land and to your children after you. Most Mefarshim understand how could the land be given to him if it's only going to be conquered later on by the children. So most Mefarshim understand that he's walking throughout the land as just a symbolic walking. Says Ramban in source 20, and amazingly he qualifies the comment with the statement, Va'aderech hapshat, that this is the most contextually lucid explanation, Sheyihyeh, really it should say Shehaya, different textual renditions here, manuscript issues, Moshe Alea Unesi Elokim Betocha Bechol Makom Sheyelech Ba'aretz Ahi. Do you notice in chapter 13, Ramban is already invoking that title that the Hittites call him later on in chapter 23 and saying that Hashem promises Lecha Etnena, yes, I am giving the land to you. You know how? Because when you walk through the land, everyone is going to look at you like you rule the land, like you are a prince in this land. So that in source 21, Ramban carries through what I like to call the class characterization, the stereotypical characterization of the Avot. He says the Avot are kings. That is why we can understand why Yitzchak is constantly asking for meat, for hunted venison from his son. He says in Source 21, Ken yasu asarim v'amlachim. This is how kings behave. They want savory food, a royal feast. Why? Because avot kulam kemlachim. The patriarchs were looked upon as kings. Kings of other nations would pay tribute to them, would seek out their good graces, would want to make treaties with them like Avimelech. So, getting back to chapter 23. If like the Ramban, what are they saying according to this reading? So let's look in the beginning of on the fourth line of Source 17, which I didn't finish reading with you. Again, Ata melech himlichacha Elokim aleinu, anachnu v'admatenu avadim lecha. Tikach kol beit hakvarot shetachpots bo, ukvor metecha sham, v'yeh lecha l'achuzat kever olam le'olam ki ish mimenu lo yimna'ehu mimecha. What do they say? What do kings have a right to do? Tikach, to take. We know Mishpat HaMelech in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. That word is a milah mancha throughout the entire declaration of Shmuel HaNavi. Are you sure you want a king? Because you know what a king does? He takes. Of course, they still ask for a king. So the Hittites say, you can take the land, whatever you want. It's in your right. Amazing, magnanimous gesture on their part. They could have said, we'll give you whatever burial site we feel like giving you. No, they have such obeisance to him. But, although Ramban maintains that they say, therefore, it will be an achuzat kever le'olam for you, he never bought, if that's the case, and he takes, he never actually buys it. And what could happen in later generations? Someone could come along and say, you were a foreign usurper. You just took what was not rightfully yours. Give it back. So what prompts them, in fact, to think that Avraham is acting in this royal manner? Well, at the beginning of Source 17. Mipnei she'amar tenu. What did he say? Tenu li achuzat kever. My, Avraham, you're acting very forceful. Give me a burial site. Chashvu, or because there are problems with the manuscripts, it might have actually said in Ramban, chashdu, obviously a block bet and dalet can easily, just erase a little line, and you get a different word. They thought, or more starkly, they suspected, that he wanted the land for a gift. And that's when they started to think, maybe Avraham is being very manipulative and underhanded here about what he really wants and how he really wants to approach them. So you know what? Avraham backtracks a little in Source 22. In Pasuk Zayin, Vayakam Avraham Vayishtachu, he bows down. Says, I've obviously ruffled some feathers here. Well, that's okay. Maybe that's exactly what he wanted to do. But now he'll backtrack. And he says in Pasuk Chet, in Source 22, Im yesh et nafshechem likbor et meti milfanai, shma'uni ufig'uli be'efron ben socha. He says, if you really want me to bury my dead, listen to me. Wait a minute. They also said, listen to me. There's a lot of listening going on here. That's because what everyone is saying is, don't just listen to my words. Listen to the underlying nuances, to the between the lines, the subtleties, the double talk. Notice he does not call them my master. So Avram one-ups them. He says, okay, let's play the game. You told me I can take any existing area that to bury my dead among all of you. Fine, I'll pick, and I want you to go to Ephraim. Ramban emphasizes in source number 23, why is it that Avraham chooses to go and ask Ephraim? Says Ramban in Source 23, where I underlined, Ani lo ekbor meti bekever acher. Listen carefully, Hittites. I am not interested in burying my dead in another person's burial site. Aval im ritzonchem shekbor meti, if you really want me to bury my dead, because of course you don't want me not to bury a dead body. Figuli be'Ephron, go and intercede on my behalf to Ephron. Why? Sheyesh lo me'ara, because he has a cave. But pay very careful attention. Ramban is quoting you from Pasuk Tet in Source 25. Let me just quote you the Pasuk. V'iten li et me'arat ha'machpelah asher lo, asher b'kseh sadehu. He has a cave, but where is it? B'kseh sadehu. It's at the edge of his property, of his field. Going back to the Ramban, in Source 23, the end of the fourth line, V'einenu lo beit kvarot avotav ki lesadehi lahem. Now, there's a lot of innuendo because Ramban is playing with the word sadeh. But in general, what Ramban is interpreting is that on the one hand, Avraham is not completely negating their offer. You want me to select from a resident of the land and choose his area? Go to Ephron. But he also does not fully give in to the Hittites either. Because while Ephron has a piece of land in the back of his property, a cave at the edge of his property, what is the key here, says Ramban? Enenu lo bet kvarot avotav. This land is not being used as a burial site for his ancestors. So on the one hand, they think Avraham is giving in to them, asking for an existing piece of property owned by someone else. But that property is not actually used as a burial site for Ephron's ancestors. So he's playing the game. Now, why does he not go to Ephron directly? Why does he need intermediaries? Well, on the one hand, Avraham could say, you called me a prince of God. It's not befitting for me to lower my status. And therefore, I am going to approach the honorable, rich, reputable Mr. Ephron, who's also like a king among the Hittites. Well, then that's a very touchy situation. Because you're asking such an honorable, reputable individual to give up ancestral land. And the Ramban says in Source 23 in the second paragraph in the third line, Ki inyan navot ha'Yisraeli. If you want to understand the delicate situation here, you need to associate this episode, what we say intertextually, with a later episode in Sefer Melachim. Now, Ramban does not elaborate, but in Source 24, I quoted you a little bit from that episode where you might remember that Ahav, King Ahav, wanted a vineyard that belonged to Navot. And Navot says very clearly, Chalila mili me'ashem mititi et nachalat avotai lach. Chas v'shalom, that I should give up ancestral land. Now it happens over there that the episode in relationship to our current narrative are not wholly aligned, because Ahav wanted a vineyard for personal pleasure, not to buy an ancestral burial site. But if you do a comprehensive study of these two episodes, you will find uncannily there are a number of parallel phrases and words that signal that Ramban, who knew Tanakh by heart, made this juxtaposition, even though obviously the Navot story is much later on. And therefore he is associating it and correlating it here to explain to you that this is a very delicate situation, that even if it's not a burial site, site, it is still ancestral land that belongs to a very honorable, reputable individual. And then Avraham says very clearly in source 25, in the middle of Pasuk Tet, "Bechesef male yitnena li betochachem la'achuzat kavel." Don't think I ever wanted a present, a gift. I am willing to pay for this land full price. Kesef male. Now, truthfully, Ramban tells you in source 26, in the last line, it's very possible that the language of give is just a euphemistic, idiomatic language that's often used in negotiations and in contractual agreements, but it means to sell. There is support for that in various ancient Near Eastern documents. However, the Hittites obviously decided to understand it their way for their own purposes. On the other hand, Ramban says in his first explanation, even though I will pay for it, I will consider it as if you gave me a gift. Because I asked you originally for this land as a resident. And as a resident, I should not have to pay for it. It should just be given to me like a gift, like my legal right. So even though I'll pay for it, I'll consider it as if you really think I'm a toshav, as if I am really a legal resident among you. Now, you have to understand. Ve'efron yoshev in source 27. They don't have to look for Ephron. He's been sitting right there the whole time. Betoch b'nei chet. He has been listening, taking it all in, thinking how is he going to make himself come out looking good as a result of these negotiations. Amazingly, in Pasuk Yud Aleph, he calls Avraham Adoni, my master. And he says, listen to me, Shma'ini, Hasadeh natati lach, Hamara shirbo lecha netatia, Le'enei b'nei chet netatia lecha kvo metecha. Notice the past tense. I gave you the sadeh, the field. I gave you the cave, in front of everyone, publicly. Go ahead, bury your dead. So Ramban says in source 28, Avraham had only asked to sell him the cave. Avraham lo haya mevakesh rak limkor lo ha-me'ara, because it's at the edge of the field, bikseh ha-sadeh. But the rest of the property, Yisher HaSadeh, will belong to Ephron. And Ephron rejoins, either, notice how Ramban is going to infuse the tone into the dialogue, and that's often a tricky thing. We have the written word. Dialogue is spoken word. And we all know we can say the same sentence in many different ways. Sincerely, sarcastically, as a question, as an exclamation. We all look at body gestures to try to figure out what the speaker really means. Well, we have the spoken word. A little difficult to extrapolate the tone. So Ramban is going to help us, but sort of. Because Ramban says, "Vehu amar lo derech musar o mirma." Ramban presents us with two different possible tones with which one may read Ephron's rejoinder. Either derech musal, by way of etiquette, sheiten lo asadeh v'hame'ara asher bo, ki lo yitachen la'adam nichbad kamo sh'tiyeh lo ha'me'ara l'achuzat kaver v'hasadeh yiyeh la'acher. Is it perhaps that Ephron is quite sincere? If you want the cave, I'm very concerned. How will you be able to access the cave? You will have to walk through my land. Better to own the whole surrounding area, including the cave. You're an honorable man. Or, oh, mirma. Or is Ephron speaking deceptively, with cunning, with guile? Abraham, you want me to sell ancestral land? Make it worth my while. I have to save my reputation among everyone who is witnessing this event. So you can't just take a cave. You need to buy a package deal, the entire area. Of course, then that means that Abraham is going to have no choice, having been blackmailed, but to accept these new terms to buy more than he originally asked for. Now, there are those mefarshim, if you skip for a moment to source 29, like that of Radak, of David Kimchi, who precedes the Ramban, and who influences the Ramban quite extensively, although the Ramban only cites Radak's name in his Perush on Sefer Breshit one time. Unfortunately, we do not have Radak's commentary on the rest of Chamisha Chumshei Torah. We only have his commentary that was preserved on Sefer Breshit. Of course, we have on Nach. The Radak says, when Ephron used the verb Natan, that part of the guile was that he was offering everything bichinam for free. Of course, the Rashbam in source 33 says, Vayishma Avraham, in the second citation of the Rashbam, Dai lechakima birmiza. If you're wise and you have wisdom, you'll understand. Ephron is offering a free gift, says Radak. What can Avraham do right now? He can't accept a gift? How is that going to make him look in front of everyone? He has no choice. But once Avraham says, of course, I accept, then Ephron, says Radak, pulls the rug out from under him and says, did you really think I wanted a free gift? I was listening the whole time. You said you would pay me. Now you're going to pay dearly. But Ramban reads things a little bit differently. Ramban does not maintain that the guile involves offering this land for free. In fact, Ramban maintains that Ephron is the quintessential businessman. We're talking about negotiations for land. No one gives up land for free. Never. Especially ancestral land. From Ramban's perspective, the only deception is that he upped the ante by including, in addition to the cave, the entire land. But I skipped a very key phrase at the end of source 28, which concludes this comment of Ramban. At the very end, on the bottom of that page, the last two words, Ve'Avraham what? Samach. Bechach ve'kana kol bedamim she'izkir lo. Now, the word simcha is a very happy term, without any kind of underlying misgivings. He was very happy. You're happy, Avraham? You've just been tricked. You've just been completely blackmailed. How is it that Ramban changes the tone of this entire narrative scene and maintains, unlike Radak and other Parshanim who precede him, that Avraham, even though we thought he has just been duped, is completely ecstatic about the changed terms of the package deal? My take on the Ramban is, you think Avraham was blackmailed and backed into a corner and had to take more than he wanted. Think again. Avraham did not have the chutzpah to ask for more than he needed, so he only asks for a cape. He doesn't want to take and act like a king. He wants to buy with a legal contract. He wants evidence that he bought this land fair and square, not through other channels that could be challenged later on. He knows to take ancestral land is a very sensitive thing. He understood who Ephron is, and he has to save face before all the people. So he doesn't ask initially beyond what he technically needs. But he knows Ephron. He picked him out of the crowd right away. That means Avraham knew Ephron from before. Ephron was not a nobody, just as Avraham was also a somebody. And so therefore, he knows Ephron is going to think to himself, a cave without hunting field that's going to create problems of access later on. And even if you want to say the cave could be accessed from the road, Ephron knows not owning that if he owns the land, it's going to infringe on his privacy. So when Ephron offers the surrounding field, even though Avram has to certainly pay more money, and he pays a lot, Avraham is thrilled, says Ramban. You know why? Because this is really what he wanted in the first place, but had not dared to ask. So in the end, says Ramban, Avraham has the upper hand. So therefore, what do we learn in source 32 for a moment, in Pasuk Yodalid, when Ephron offers his price, it's 400 silver pieces. If you compare that to other places in Tanakh where money is mentioned, this is an exorbitant price. Now, some Mefarshim maintain, as quoted by the Ramban in source 34, that this was part of the whole hypocrisy of the way Ephron dealt with Avraham, that he asked him for a price beyond which, that the value was of the land was not equal to this price. It was exorbitant, it was extortionate, but what could Avraham do? He had to pay for it. It happens, Ramban, interestingly enough, maintains opposite. He claims that once the general terms of the deal have been agreed upon, it only remains to bring it to its logical conclusion. And by invoking their mutually wealthy status, Ephron says he presumes Avraham will have no trouble giving him the worth of the land at its original purchase price. Ramban maintains, if you want this to be a true contractual deal, a legal acquisition of the land, then it has to be a fair transaction in which Avraham sufficiently compensates Ephron for giving up part of his ancestral inheritance what it really is truly worth. Now, it's possible Ramban cannot conceive of Ephron fabricating an extortionate price in front of the Hittites. In his view, once the deal is accepted, it's concluded equitably. But notice what Ephron had said. He had said, Kvol metecha, go ahead and bury your dead right away. What Ephron seemed to have intimated is that Avraham could immediately bury his dead. We'll work out the details later. It's as if, go bury your dead before you sign on the dotted line and the ink is dry. As Ramban says in source 30, where I underline, Kvol meitecha sham me'ata, now, shelchai, it's already yours, natati, past tense, lo chalashuv, I won't renege on the deal. Well, Avraham knows better. And therefore, Ramban maintains, let's read carefully source 35, the pasukim that conclude this narrative. Vayakam. I'm sorry, let's go back to Pasuk Ted Zion in source 32. Vayishma Avraham el Ephron, Vayishkol Avraham le Ephron et hakesef. He gives him exactly what Ephron had demanded. Source 35, Pasuk Yud Zion. Vayakam Sde Ephron, Asher b'machpelah, Asher lifnei Mamre, Hasadeh, Hame'ara Asher bo, Chol ha'etz Asher b'sadeh, Asher b'chol gvulo saviv, Le Avraham le mikne, Le'enei b'enei chet b'chol ba'ei shar iro. Says Ramban in source 36, where I underlined. It's only first he has to do what? Para hakesef male hechazik tchila besader v'amara v'kimam birshuto le'enei b'nei ha'ir v'chol ba'ei shar ha'ir. The first thing Avraham does is he has a mikneh, an actual possession, an acquisition. He buys the land. It's as if he puts a flag on the property and he says, this land, before everyone, belongs to me. Notice the detailed stipulation of the borders to the point that we're talking about the tree that was in the field. And only in Pasuk Yud Tet in source 35, Ve'acharechein, only afterwards, kavar Avraham et Sarah ishto el me'arat zdeh ha'machpelah al pnei mamre hu chevron be'eretz kena'an. Notice, Only afterwards he buries her and says the Rav. First there has to be mikne, a kinyan. Then it becomes truly something that's an achuzah that belongs to you. Something that is yours, and that's why the emphasis is hu chevron be'eretz Kanan. We know chevron is in Eretz Kanan, but it's because he bought for the very first time. This is the very first purchase of land, legally, contractually, in Eretz Kanan.
It's the title of the book.
Correct. Amazingly, there and therefore, notice in sources 37 and 38, when Avraham himself is buried by Yitzchak and Ishmael, what do we read in Perek Chafei? Notice the details of the area where he is buried. We know it already, but notice the details that are reiterated. Ma'arat ha-machpelah, Sefron be'sochar, ha-chiti, p'nei mamre, ha-sadeh asher kana Avraham, etc. Source 38, when Yaakov asks to be buried in Canaan, he commands his children, kivrote el avotai, where? El ha-ma'ara, asher b'stei Efron ha-chiti, ba-ma'ara, asher b'stei ha-machpelah, asher kana Avraham. Look at the lengthy descriptions, so that it is completely clear where our avot were buried. So therefore, in source 39, Ramban explains, V'nichteva zot ha-parasha. What can we learn from this parasha? Now, by the way, Ramban is not often one within his analysis of biblical narrative to take a step aside and say, let's learn something from the text, and I'm going to give you the lessons. Usually, he lets you read his commentary on the narrative, and you have to extrapolate the pedagogy and the ideology that emerges from his analysis of these texts. But here, Ramban thought it was so important that we take a step back, and we really look globally at what we have learned from this very critical perek in Sefer Breshit. Lehodia chazdei Hashem im Avraham. It teaches, first of all, the kindness of Hashem with Avraham. Shehaya nesi Elohim ba'aretz asher ba lagur sham, v'hayachid v'chol ha'am hayu kor'in lo Adoni, v'hu lo amar lahem ken. Shehaya sar v'gadol v'gam b'chayav kiyem lo, v'agadla shmecha v'heyei beracha. Hashem had commanded, Lech lecha me'artzecha, right? Ve'escha legoy gadol, and then what? Ve'agedla shemech, I will make your name great, you will be a blessing. Says Ramban, this is the proof that the promise was fulfilled. That Avraham was in the Nesi Elohim, that everyone is calling him my master, they're not calling Avraham with the same epithet. This is not just formal ways, means of address. This proves Hashem fulfilled in Avraham's lifetime the Agadla Shemecha. Of course, it's very important to know that his wife was buried b'nachalat Hashem, and we know where Kivrei Avot is. So much so, so momentous is this event, that the Chizkuni, 13th century Spanish commentator, tells us, I'm sorry, French commentator tells us, in source 40, Chizkiyahu bar Manoach, who was probably contemporaneous with the Ramban. He tells us, if we learn about the death of Sarah, and we don't usually learn about the death of women in Sefer Breshit, he says, if you look on the next page, Bishvil shehotzi Avraham damim yikarim lekovera velo hirher vezeo echad me'asara ha'nisyonot. Most of us have learned that the last test which Avraham passed was what? The test of the Akedah. Now, the tests are never enumerated for us. In Pirkei Avot, it just says, Ve'asara nisyonot nitnasa Avraham, and that's why there's a machloket. What are the 10? Says Rav Chizkiyahu bar Manoach, the 10th test was this challenge that he had to go through the negotiation process. He had to pay dearly for the burial site for Avraham, for Sarah, and for future descendants. And yet, lo hirher, he didn't question why he had to go through this toil and effort. But you know what? The Rav in Source 41 has an explanation why the toil and effort was so critical to acquiring this burial site of Me'arat HaMachpelah. The Rav, in an essay called Lispod Sarah V'Livkota, says, Rechishat Nechasim Belo Hashka'at Amal Ze'at Apayim Me'orer Hitnagdut Memechina Musarit. זכות הקניין במקרה שכזה איננה מושלמת. הכסף מייצג יגיעה, לאות, זאת העובד, תשישותו הפיזית. על כן הנכסים שאני רוכש הם לחלוטין נכסי שלי. אין ספק שאברהם לא רצה ששרה טובה נוחת עולמים בקבר שניתן לו כמתנה, כמענק. קבר שלא קודש על ידי זיעת אפיים ויגיעה קשה. Says the Rav, if you get something, you acquire something without sweat, without effort, without toil, it's not really yours. It's the effort, it's the amal, it's the le'ut, it's the fatigue, it's the zeah, it's the sweat that all went into it, where you can stand up and say, Nechasai Sheli, this is mine. And Abraham wanted for a Kiddush Hashem to acquire the first piece of land in Canaan. It should be acquired through what? Amal and Yigi'ah. Let's conclude with the very famous Rashi at the beginning of Sefer Bereshit. A very Zionistic Rashi. The first Rashi of Sefer Bereshit asks the famous question, why did the Torah begin with a story? With the creation story. If Torah means hora'ah, instruction, a guidebook, it should have begun with mitzvot. That's logical. Answers Rashi through a midrashic exposition. Go to the middle of the fifth line. She'im yomru umot ha'olam li'Israel, if the nations of the world will say to Israel, listim atem, you are ganavim, you are thieves. She'kvashtem artzot shivat goyim, because you took away the land that belongs to seven nations. We answer the goyim, kol ha'aret shel ha'kadosh baruch hu hi, the whole world belongs to Hashem. Hu bara'ah, Hashem created it. That means he's not merely a creator, and like the deists maintain, he created the world, put the world on autopilot, and it just operates automatically, and Hashem has nothing to do with the world. No. Says Rashi, the creation story wants to teach you, if you think about it, day one, day two, day three, there's a lot of effort Hashem put into it. Truthfully, Hashem could have just done it all in one moment, and we have texts that testified to that in Tehillim. Ki hu amar vayehi, hu tziva v'yamod. Why do we need 6 days of creation? Because we want to be able to understand in some way, shape, or form the effort, the toil, the care, the consideration that Hashem put into creation, which means he's not creating the world and leaving it. Hu bara'ah, he's a creator, but he's a ruler and a master over the world and of history. Netanah la'asher yashar beinav. Hashem can dole out the world to whomever he sees fit. Birtzono netana lahem. At one point he gave it to them. Uvirtzono netala mehem unetana lanu. At some one point he took it away from them and gave it to us. So truthfully, our taina to the rest of the world is whatever Hashem decides, if we're in the land now, we should stop having guilty consciences, and we should understand the way the land is ours because Hashem decided it belongs to us now. Ah, but the goyim always have tainus. And therefore the Midrash in Source 45 says there are three places in the world. She'ein umot ha'olam yicholin lahonot et Yisrael. Lomar gizulim hein biyedechem. There are three places in the world that supposedly the nations of the world cannot torture us and oppress us and claim that we are thieves. One of them is Me'arat HaMachpelah. The second place which we will focus on is the area of the Beit HaMikdash. I quoted you from Source 44. Amnon Bazak points out very importantly that there are important parallels between the texts of the acquisition of the goren, of the threshing floor from Aravna, the remaining chieftain of the Yevusi, who are still left in Yerushalayim in the time of David HaMelech. David is a king then. Aravna says, take, yikach, it's your king, you can take. No, David says, I'm buying this land, and this is the area which becomes the future site of the Beit HaMikdash. So amazingly, as I was reviewing this shir over Shabbat, and I was looking through some of the parashanim on the Midrash, there's a parashan Yifat Toal, and he says on this Midrash, he says, Be'emet, Ein ta'ana lahem al kol Eretz Yisrael ki Hashem natan la'asher yashar be'enav. They have no claim against us. Hashem gave the land to us. That is our claim to the land. Nevertheless, k'tzat ta'ana yesh lahem, they always have tainus. Even if it's a ta'anat hevel, even if it's a false claim, they will say, lo ye'ot la'avurei achsanta afilu mibrabisha libratava. It's not nice that you took us away from our land, even if it's going from bad people to good people. It's still, you don't take away land. So therefore, Amar, the Midrash says, at least these three places, lo tov lanu ki tiye lahem gam k'tzat ta'ana. They shouldn't even have any kind of taina, at least the place of the Beit HaMikdash and the area of the burial site of the Tzadikim. Let's hope that the Midrash and its hopes that we own these areas legally and contractually, and that Avraham made sure of it, that it should come true for the future times. Thank you. The Kfura of Yosef in Shrem.
Wow, thank you so much, Dr. Levine. That was really great. Thank you. Thank you all for coming out to the Midrash HaYom Rishon here, hosted this morning by Congregation Beth Midrash Women's Org. I'd like to draw your attention to the sponsor sheet in particular, Gail Torsky and Deborah Zohar for sponsoring this morning in honor of their mothers. And to all the other sponsors, obviously, Midrash HaYom Rishon can't happen without support from everybody. So thank you for coming. I actually don't know the date of the next Midrash HaYom Rishon, but hopefully you sign the sign-in sheet and put down. It's going around. The first or the second Sunday of December. Okay, so be on the lookout for the email, and thank you so much for coming.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
It was wonderful. And do you think that Sarah died because immediately after Maria, because she did not, she didn't think it was a season down the season? I'm going to go to the next one.
Oh, Baruch Hashem.